Hello. Test.
Here and I see some familiar faces and colleagues and friends and so on, and students. It's a very excellent idea to broaden our forum that is normally a narrow event for staff and PhD students to the broader world, and to bring our illustrious alumni, Sergei Radchenko. You know, I've prepared myself. I'm like Leonid Brezhnev, trying to read what I wrote. Radchenko does not need an introduction, but I will do it anyway. So stay silent. He's a Lucy E. Schmidt Distinguished Professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, which is in Bologna, Italy, on top of other attractions. He has written extensively, of course, and I would mention many, many books, among them Two Suns in the Heavens, the Sino-Soviet Struggle for Supremacy, and Unwanted Visionaries, which is on my shelf all the time. The Soviet Failure in Asia adds to the literature of failures that Gorbachev is so famous for. Okay, and his forthcoming book, which took some time in writing and preparation and research, is called To Run the World. So I'm sure everyone wants me to just finish and Sergei to speak. So without further ado, what we'll do, you will introduce your book, the idea and why you wrote it, and then we'll open it to the floor. I have my own questions. I will contain myself so that students will be able to raise their own points and questions.
Thank you for this very kind introduction, and I'm so honored to actually be doing the talk, which is chaired by Vlad Zubok, who is the leading person to really talk about this book, other than me, of course. Yeah, I'll talk about it, but I think if there's anybody who would actually critique it, indeed, and I know he will not do that because we're good friends, but if anybody would really tear it apart, I think it's Vlad Zubov. So I'm really honored to be, thank you, Vlad, for inviting me, honored to be here also, really pleased to see some friends of long ago. Of course, some of you may or may not know, I used to be at the LC, that's my alma mater. After all, I graduated from here, I did my undergraduate degree here, and also my PhD as well, which was...
With Arnie Westad.
With Arnie Westad, which was a long, long time ago. Seemingly different galaxy, but I still recognize some parts of it anyway. The OLC has changed. Anyway, To Run the World, this is a new book that I have been working on. It's coming out with Cambridge University Press anytime I'm supposed to. I haven't seen it. I would have brought it here to show you this doorstopper. You know, it's also a weapon of defense. It is a very long book. And I'm very glad that Cambridge University Press actually decided to publish it after seeing the length. I think it's more than 300,000 words, which is challenging, put it this way. It's challenging. It was a challenging book to write, and it was also a challenging book to try to cut. And I did it in the end, end up cutting it. And there are so many things that I did not say that I wanted to say. And at one point, I even wrote to Cambridge University Press and I said, why don't you publish 3 volumes? They just laughed at me. They said, what are you talking about? So in the end, I just have 1 volume that covers Soviet foreign policy from 1943 or so, 1943 approximately to 1991. And of course, there's a long epilogue. Oh, I had to do that. I had to do an epilogue, which includes Putin in the book. So it's an effort to really connect the past and the present. Maybe historians should not really do that. Somehow I felt tempted to do that. I have to connect it to the present as well. Why should, you know, especially after Vlad Zubov's great books on this subject, why should anybody write anything that, you know, potentially challenged? It's a good question. It's a good question.
It's a free country. Free
it's a free country. Well, there. The main reason, I'll tell you the main reason for this. The main reason for this was the remarkable availability of new materials on the Cold War. And that's something that, who would have expected this? Who would have expected that suddenly in approximately 2013, 2014, the Russian government would start declassifying vast troves of documentation on the Cold War and crazy amount. That time I spent a month in Moscow basically going through this material. I felt like I was drowning in just all sorts of materials that allows us to really look at some at different crises, you know, personalities, things that we thought we knew everything about. Turns out we didn't really know enough about. There's all this stuff. I don't know why they did it. I have no idea. I think Vlad and I have had a discussion about this a number of times, and I think we have a consensus that it's not by design. It's just something that just happens. You know, one of those things that happened in Russia. They just decided to declassify. They were holding on to these documents, and they decided to declassify these documents. By the way, before I spent all this time in Russia looking at all these materials from the Russian archives, I also spent some time in China. So I lived in China for about 5 years. And this was the time where the Chinese had relative openness. They shut things down with the arrival of Xi Jinping, so approximately 2012-2013. Things were shut down. But the time that I was there in China, I was able to collect a lot of materials on Chinese foreign policy. And that is another major aspect of the book. So although the book's subtitle is called something, what's it? The Kremlin's Cold War Bid for Power. The reality is that it is, yes, mainly about the Soviet Union, Soviet foreign policy in the Cold War, but also there's a big Chinese angle to this. So those of you interested in China's foreign policy during the Cold War will find a lot of new material in the book drawn actually on the Chinese sources. Now there's another important reason to include China. I think when we talk about Soviet foreign policy during the Cold War, traditionally, we focus a lot on Europe, medium, you know, sometimes global affairs, Soviet-American relations, but we haven't really had enough appreciation of the Chinese angle in Soviet foreign policy. Now, one of the things I discovered while writing this book is just how obsessed Soviet leaders were about China. Almost every decision they made, maybe not under Stalin. Stalin was less concerned, although China was also a big part of his imagination. But certainly after Stalin's death, with Khrushchev coming to power, almost every decision the Soviet leaders made on key issues had to do with, or they looked towards China, and they were trying to figure out, what would the Chinese think about this? And that's actually very interesting and very important. Actually, that comes to this big argument that I will talk about in a second that the book makes. But before I finish with this long explanation of this great archival documents and what they tell us, let me just say this. What is the importance of this? What is the importance of having all this documents, all this, you know, tens of thousands of pages of materials, including, for example, personal papers of Nikita Khrushchev and Brezhnev and all of those people? It's that you get a sense of these people as people. They stop being inaccessible heavenly dwellers in the Kremlin. They come down to earth and you start to understand what kind of people they were, what their obsessions were, what their fears were, what they liked, what they did not like. And I think that really allows us to approach Cold War history and Cold War crises with a new level of understanding of Soviet motivations. And sometimes those, you know, even the word Soviet motivations is too broad. Khrushchev's motivations, Brezhnev's motivations, well, what were these people about? What did they want? When writing this book, I felt often like a psychiatrist in a session with these people. Of course, you know, they would just pour forth their various concerns time and again. Khrushchev was very good for this, by the way. Khrushchev had this thing. Khrushchev didn't really read anything. Okay, that's well known. He never read much. He didn't write much either. That's also well known. But did you know that Khrushchev liked to talk? Well, we know that he liked to talk, but did you know that there were stenographers who would write down everything that he said in the Kremlin? So that one of the most interesting things in those materials are Khrushchev's dictations on random subjects. So he would just dictate things. Like, for example, let's say during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he would dictate a letter to John Kennedy. Now, we have those letters. Well, there's my colleague Frank.
Hello, Frank. Sir.
Frank has
all in the front, yeah.
Frank has come to the front in order to intimidate me.
I come only to praise.
Where was I? I was on
dictation during the
Cuban Missile Crisis. Can you believe this? I mean, this guy you'd expect that Khrushchev's letters to Kennedy would be written by Khrushchev, but actually what happened is he dictated them, and of course he rambled and he would go off and say all kinds of crazy, crazy things, and then the foreign minister would come and try to present it into something that could actually be sent to President Kennedy. And so when you have access to the source material, you really understand these people. You really train, you know, you really sort of, it's like you're in there, like in the room with them, and they tell you what they were thinking. So what were they thinking? Okay, well, that gets me to the key arguments of the book. So I take this broader view along the way of Soviet and almost, you know, just Soviet and Russian foreign policy, and ask this question: what is it they wanted above all? And the argument that I'm making is that they craved legitimacy. They wanted to have legitimacy. Somehow they felt they did not have legitimacy. I don't know why that is, that this, well, these people, that they felt that they did not have legitimacy. Maybe it's because they didn't have elections. Maybe that's why, explanations. Who knows? But they wanted legitimacy. They felt that just raw power, that's even true even for Stalin. Even Stalin felt that just raw power was not enough. You have to have legitimacy. You have to have somebody recognizing that you are legitimate and your claims are legitimate. And that is true from Stalin to Khrushchev to Brezhnev to even Gorbachev. They wanted recognition. They wanted recognition by who is the big question. That's a question I try to ask in the book in different places. And the answer seems to be, it's actually not straightforward. So first of all, they wanted recognition you would expect by some big power. They didn't want to be recognized by, I don't know, let's say Iceland. They didn't care for Iceland's recognition. Why is that? Iceland's a wonderful country, but no, that's not. You have to be recognized by somebody great. Who's great? The United States. So they wanted American recognition. They wanted to be equal with the United States, or even more than equal, but they wanted American recognition as a great, great power. And you can see this in all of their foreign policy, from Stalin through to Gorbachev, this desire to be seen as a great power next to the United States. That's not the only kind of recognition that they wanted, and this is where it becomes complicated, because they also, and this is where ideology comes into the picture, because people who haven't the book say that I downplay ideology. I don't really downplay it all that much. Ideology did matter. So for the Soviets, what they wanted was also recognition of it's a great revolutionary power. And the audience for that kind of recognition, the recognizers in this case, are somebody else who, not the United States, surely. Well, the answer seems to be the revolutionary world. And what is the so-called revolutionary world? The key player is China, actually. That's where I say China becomes hugely important for Soviet policymaking. And every crisis, everything that they did, they look back to China and say, oh, what are the Chinese thinking? Are they approving of us? Or are they going to challenge us? Are they going to challenge our leadership in the world communist movement? That's just such a driving concern for them. So they had this two kind of recognitions that they really wanted, one by the United States, the other by the revolutionary world slash China. And those two types of recognition were in perpetual conflict with one another. I'll give you an example of how that worked out. So for example, let's take the war in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam was something pretty nasty as far as the Soviets were concerned. They didn't want it to go on. They thought that the war in Vietnam undermined their, in this case, Brezhnev's willingness to build a better relationship with the United States. He wanted detente. And here comes Vietnam, and that drags the whole thing down. And so the Soviets were, on the one hand, I mean, the Americans obviously wanted the Soviets to help them to find a way for the United States out of Vietnam. Hence the idea that Henry Kissinger was putting forward, the idea of linkage. Okay, you help us in Vietnam, we will give you detente, or something like that, right? We'll give you trade. And the Soviets were uncertain about it. They were uncertain about it because on the one hand, they did want to have a good relationship with the United States, and sometimes they felt frustrated by what the Vietnamese were doing. On the other hand, actually kind of selling out Vietnam would look very bad for them, and they wanted to be seen as leaders with a clientele in the global south, or as they called it, the third world. At the time, Vietnam was a key country, so they wanted to support Vietnam as well. And so those two facets of recognition are obviously in a clash, which is why detente as a process was doomed to failure. It was very difficult to reconcile those two things. The Soviets, by the way, never squared this circle, because they thought, well, what's the problem? We are a great power on par with the United States. We want to have our clients. If the Americans want to export counter-revolution, let them. We want to export revolution. The fact that we have clients around the world just highlights our great power status. So that is not a contradiction. They never figured this out. But in practice, they try to figure it out. I'll give you an example. And by the way, this shows how you can use documents to try to capture this particular moment in Soviet psychology, Soviet leader psychology. One interesting moment came during Nixon's visit to Moscow in May 1972. All right, so if you know the history of this, up until the summit of 1972, there was an escalation in Vietnam. The United States was following the so-called spring offensive. The United States was bombing Vietnam, and actually it came pretty close to the summit being canceled. Now, Brezhnev did not want to cancel the summit because he wanted Brezhnev in Moscow. He wanted Nixon in Moscow. He wanted this summit to take place despite Vietnam. So anyway, Nixon comes to Moscow, and in his memoirs he recounts the story of meeting Brezhnev, where he says, "We were having this lovely discussion, everything was going great, And then suddenly, Brezhnev just starts shouting, "You are bloodthirsty imperialists, what are you doing in Vietnam? You should get out of Vietnam, etc." And then suddenly, he stopped doing that and again returned to pleasantries. And so Nixon in his memoir says, "I don't understand, what, how do you even explain this?" So now we have the Russian record, we can explain it perfectly well. Guess why Brezhnev did this? Anybody wants to, anybody knows? Any idea?
They're too shy, they know probably.
You know this, it's all pretty obvious, you think, no? Okay, I'll tell you. So Brezhnev wanted a record of conversation that would show him trashing Nixon for Vietnam. Why did he want to have a record of conversation like this? Because then he went to the party plenum and he read out a speech in which he cited from the parts of the conversation where he trashed Nixon for Vietnam. Why is that? In order to tell to the party elites, look at this, we are really trashing America for Vietnam, so we're really defending the revolutionary interests. Then he sent this record of conversation to the Vietnamese with, I think Podgorny was the only one there, Podgorny took it to Vietnam to show to the Vietnamese, to prove to the Vietnamese allies that the Soviets are really defending their interests. And then he also showed it, guess who, to Castro, because Castro also showed up in Moscow, and they really wanted to win Castro's support, etc. So look at this, you know, we're really fighting against American imperialism. So that is where a lot of those things come together. You realize that, you know, at one level, it's one thing to read the Pravda newspaper, and it's another thing to read all these documents and realize just how complicated Brezhnev's balancing act was. Brezhnev, by the way, loved Nixon. He really fell in love with Nixon. In June 1973, he traveled to Washington, and there were these wonderful discussions in Washington, Camp David. By the way, this is where having what is called multi-archival research becomes very important, because we have the American record of these discussions, we have had them for a long time, but guess what, they don't mention crucial bits. Why is that? Because Henry Kissinger was the note taker, and in key meetings, basically he would leave. And Brezhnev would say, like, for example, they had one meeting at Camp David where the most interesting part of the discussion happened after Kissinger left. Why is that? It was about the Middle East. And Brezhnev did not want to raise the Middle East because he thought that Kissinger was pro-Israeli, being Jewish, etc. So, you know, you kind of try to figure this out. It becomes really bizarre. By the way, the most interesting part of the summit, well, not the most interesting part, but one fun fact about Brezhnev's visit to Washington in June 1973 is we have the only time we actually have, I think it's probably the only time, I think the only time, we have an actual voice recording of a private one-to-one meeting between the Soviet leader and the American leader. It was in the Oval Office. And of course, guess why we have that? Because Nixon was taking the Oval Office, which is one of the things that brought him down next year. But anyway, so we have that. And it's remarkable to listen to, because, and this word is very different from actual published document. That's why you never want to trust the documents, which I do all the time. But if you compare the published version that was published by Foreign Relations of the United States, and then the spoken version, you realize that they're very, very different, because the American version that was published was actually the version that was translated by the Soviet interpreter, Sukhadev, who actually changed a lot of the wording and smoothed it so that it did not seem like Brezhnev was kissing up to Nixon, which of course he was. Anyway, are we out of time yet? Almost.
Maybe if you finish.
I've got, I see the clock. I'll tell you a couple more anecdotes from this book, which I think you'll find very entertaining. So one that I like to mention is just how obsessed Brezhnev was with this idea of equality with the United States. And you know what drove him crazy? When in February 1972, President Nixon went to China, he met with Mao Zedong, he also met with Zhou Enlai. And then he had one of those drunken receptions where he was drinking Mao Tai. And so he made a toast, which was reported by the New York Times, because it was public first, no public toast. He said, the United States and China hold the fate of the world in their hands. Well, guess what? Brezhnev did not like this. Well, the United States and China hold the world in their hands. Remember, China at that time is the Soviets' enemy number one. They are going crazy about China because there had been a cultural revolution. You know, we had basically a border war between them in March 1969. So things are really not going well. By the way, China, the conflict with China is one of the reasons that Brezhnev has been now turns towards detente with Europe and with the United States. If that happens, it's approximately with that period. But he was really driven crazy by the fact that Nixon said that he held the fate of the world, China and the United States held the fate of the world in their hands. How dare he say something like that publicly? Absolutely unacceptable. So Brezhnev, when Kissinger later visited Moscow in April 1972, Brezhnev raised that. He's like, why are you saying this? And Kissinger said, well, it's because Nixon was drunk. Okay, so that's fine. Later, when Brezhnev went to the United States, he spent some time in Washington, Camp David, but then he flew to California, where Nixon had his California White House, or the Western White House. And they had very interesting discussions, which are mostly not reflected in the American record because, for whatever reason, you know, Kissinger was not there, they did not take notes, whatever. The Soviets always do. So we have that in the Soviet record, and the most interesting part comes where they have this dinner, late night dinner at Nixon's house. And Nixon makes a toast and says, actually, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States hold the future of the world in their hands.
Without Mao Tse.
But the interesting thing is that Brezhnev then circulates this to the Politburo, which of course, you know, has a classification, top secret, but he tells the truth. This is who holds the world in their hands. This is very important. So for him, of course, it was hugely, hugely important. Right, I think, I've spoken enough, I think, about the different aspects of this book. And maybe if we have a broader discussion, I'll be able to touch on some other interesting anecdotes. But that's basically where we find ourselves. Now, one last thing that I wanted to mention, that's why the book actually mentions Putin. Why would you do that? And that is that I think this book is kind of unusual in the sense that it does not, it sees a lot of continuity between the Cold War and the post-Cold War. And this is a little bit new in the sense that we had the end of the Cold War in 89, 91, whatever you want to end it, you know, the end of an era. And then we had a development of the Cold War historiography here. Vlad Zubakir was a prominent number one figure in doing that on the Russian side. And then, you know, who would have known back in 90, when was the Kremlin's Cold War published in 96, I think?
Yeah, 96.
96. I mean, you would have not imagined the world that we're living in today.
No.
I mean, I was too young to imagine it at that point, but I was embracing this new world. I was like, wow, look at this. It's a wonderful world that we're living in. And I did not expect that it would turn out this way. But then, you know, you come to this point today and you realize that actually, if you look back, you realize that there are a lot of continuities that go from the Cold War and that seem to have deeper roots than simply just the Cold War and ideology and the things that we used to talk about. And that's what I try to pin down in the book. I try to understand what are these deeper roots? What is this craving for recognition? What is this craving for greatness? What is this desire to quote the title of the book, To Run the World? By the way, it comes from Brezhnev's proposal to Kissinger. When Kissinger visited Moscow in the spring of 1973, Brezhnev took him hunting boars. Mm-hmm. Imagine Kissinger hunting boars. So they were in the tower, and there was just Kissinger with Brezhnev, and it was Sukhodev being the interpreter. And Brezhnev basically tell them, well, how about, you know, we just co-manage the world in the United States. You all would need this offer. So this idea to run the world, you can see it running like thread throughout Soviet foreign policy. And I was trying to get to the bottom of this. But one thing I recognize is that even after the Soviet Union collapsed, this idea somehow survived, this idea of trying to run the world. And so I was trying to get to the bottom of this and understand factors that drove this determination on the part of the Soviets and now increasingly the Russian leaders to be out there, to want to be out there and, you know, running the world with the greats of this world. Okay, I'll leave it here, and then I guess we can open to questions.
Okay.
The last point struck me as very important, continuity or breaking continuity, and we can go into different directions. You can go into different directions, it seems. If you go to, let's say, you know, structural explanations, neorealists here in, you know, somewhere at the LSE, IR specialists, IR theorists would agree with you that a great power tries to find its place in an international system, addressing who? The hegemon, the top power. So this is one direction. So, you know, for Russia or the Soviet Union, the dilemma is the same. Either we are accepted as co-runners of the system, or we pushed outside and become the main enemy, which we see today, right? Or you can go into a direction of psychology, which you mentioned, and I noticed, and that's my question actually, how much you were influenced by great Russian literature. You keep quoting Dostoevsky, and the fact that actually rhymes with what Kissinger says in his memoirs, that Russians are, unlike Chinese, Kissinger said, Russians are so historically insecure. This is just their national psychology. They are never secure, whatever you do. So, you know, where would you go if you take this choice, you know, to international relations theory or to psychology of Dostoevsky?
So I think, wow, this is a great question. I, actually, in my introduction, I try to do both, and I really go out on thin ice. This is stuff that, as a historian, I felt very uncomfortable doing. I engaging with rival disciplines, trying to, you know, go on to psychology, trying to engage with some IR literature, which I think is actually a useful thing to do. It's a useful thing.
Thank you for this. Yes.
No. Seriously, because sometimes we feel like we're, you know, we end up just in our little bunkers, in our little holes, disciplinary holes. We don't go out there enough, I think. And we should go outside of the field of history as historians and try to see what others have to say. And indeed, even Dostoevsky makes an appearance in the book a number of times, and I'll tell you how. Okay, so Dostoevsky comes up in the context of Crime and Punishment, which is a very nice book I first read when I was probably 12 or 13 years old, which I did not understand at that time. They always make you read it in the Russian school, Crime and Punishment, but nobody understands it anymore. But then I reread it. There's a very interesting, I highly recommend the book to you, there's the main character is somebody called Ion Raskolnikov, who kills a pawnbroker lady and her sister. Pawnbroker lady on purpose, sister by accident. He basically goes there to try to steal the money from the pawnbroker lady. And the reason he wants to get the money, he's got this long monologue. He tries to explain why he needs to have money. And he brings in Napoleon. He says, well, if Napoleon, at the beginning of his career, thought, okay, just to succeed in this career, this is a guy who's really, really poor. Poor student. He's a poor student, has no money. And he's thinking, to succeed, I just need a little money. Would Napoleon have stopped before this ethical rule? Do not kill people to get a little money. And he basically concludes, probably not. You know, he would have still done it. And you might wonder, what the hell does that have to do with anything? So I do actually bring it into the in the book, and actually it comes up in several places, because you can see this idea, you can see this in it, this desire to challenge the West and to dare the West. And Raskolnikov says something in this little monologue. He says, am I a trembling creature, or do I have the right? Am I a trembling creature, or do I have the right? The right meaning the right to do whatever I want. Who's there to stop me? And I think the Soviets also come, and then later Putin, come to the same conclusion. What brings Khrushchev to this is the empowering agency of atomic weapons. He discovers the bomb and he feels, wow, I can destroy the world with this. What are they going to do to me? You know, what are they going to do? So I am entitled to A, B, C, and D. What am I, trembling creature? Do I have the right? Of course I have the right, because I can do whatever I want. I've got the bomb, right? You have this psychology, and you can see very clearly how Khrushchev comes to love the bomb in the mid-1950s and how he uses it in the Suez Crisis, for example, of which I write, learns the wrong lesson, then takes it later to the Berlin Crisis, and ultimately to the Cuban Missile Crisis. With Khrushchev, though, and this is interesting, Khrushchev knew the limits, though. Thankfully, that's why we're still alive. With Khrushchev, and I talk about those limits, not so much in the chapter on the Cuban Missile Crisis, which Vlad knows about, but also in this chapter that I wrote very late in the book. Actually, it was Frank's idea. Frank here read the draft of the book and said, okay, where's Berlin? And I said, well, you know, that's interesting. I wrote a book about the Cold War and forgot about Berlin. So I put in a chapter in Berlin. And in Berlin, you've got this moment where Khrushchev thinks, okay, we can take Berlin. We can take Berlin. This is the Berlin ultimatum, Berlin crisis. And then when push comes to shove, of course, he doesn't. And the question is, why doesn't he do that? And the answer is very interesting. So during the height of the Berlin Crisis, in the summer of 1961, he has these discussions in the Politburo. And he's, you know, he's got this very kind of bravado approach to the crisis. What are the chances of war with the United States? Why would the Americans actually, they want to set is to have a nuclear war? The Soviet Union, for what? For Berlin? Who cares about Berlin? Why would they do that? You know, for Berlin, they will never do. So then they have this discussion of the chances of war over Berlin, and they decide, Khrushchev decides it's 5% chance. It's 5% chance. I don't know. He took it off the ceiling. 5%. Here it comes. The God sent it down to him. So he says 5%, that's pretty good. But then when push comes to shove, he does not act on this. I mean, if you were a gambler and you would say the chances of winning are 95%, you would say, oh yeah, I'll gamble my salary right there. But Khrushchev doesn't do that because the stakes are so much higher. And one of the things that he does in the context of the discussion of Berlin, which I found really quite remarkable, is he suddenly remembers the opening days of the Second World War when the Germans, well, not the Second World War, but the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the Germans are rolling through Ukraine. There was a guy who was in charge of one of the Soviet tank armies, a guy called Nikolai Vashugin, who was at the front, and then his tank army got beaten. So he goes to Khrushchev, he says, I lost my tank army, what should I do? And Khrushchev's like, well, what do you propose? And the guy pulls out a gun and shoots himself in the head, lost his brains out. So Khrushchev talks about that in the context of discussion on Berlin. And
very much Russian roulette.
Isn't it? It's very interesting. And she's like, no, that's a roulette with, that's a Russian roulette, but with bullets in every.
Full stop.
This is more than a Russian plus. And so Khrushchev talks about it in the context of the Berlin Crisis, which shows that he did not ultimately believe in human rationality. He thought that even though it seems like it's natural for the Americans to back off, and it's 5% chance of war, but what if it's not 5%? What if it's 50%? Who knows? We can never know. So that's why he backed off. So Khrushchev knew his limits, but then that's because he had a particular kind of historical experience. And then I turn to Putin towards the end of the book, and I say, well, does Putin have this kind of historical experience? Because he doesn't. He doesn't. That's what makes me worried. That's what makes me worried.
Let's open the floor, Xinfei, and then Jeff, and then you in the back. Let's ask a few questions, and then because Sergei, you have so many interesting things to say.
I can talk forever.
Yes, Xinfei, you start, and then we collect.
Thank you, Vlad. Thank you for this wonderful talk. I'm Xinfei. I teach the PRC Foreign Relations at the History Department. I'm going to meet my student in that seminar in about an hour. So obviously, they've all read your Two Sons in the Heaven. And my question is, now with all this new material and new angle, what would be the single arguments several arguments you would like to revise or amend from that previous book? Mm-hmm. I hope I can relay that to my students.
Thank you. That's very good.
And then Jeff?
So as the Cold War continued past the Nixon era, we saw U.S. foreign policy become more predicated, especially under Carter, but kind of continuing under Reagan, coming out of the legislature, on human rights interests. Mm-hmm. And how did the Soviet leadership respond to that? Did they think this was coming from like a genuine advocacy of human rights, or was it like this is some sort of sinister American plot? And once we figure out what they want, we can make a deal. Mm-hmm. Like, has that continued through to the Putin?
That's a great question.
Mm-hmm. Maybe two great questions, and you'll answer as brief as possible.
Okay, so very briefly on Qingfei's question. So first of all, you know, Two Sons of the Heavens is a very old book, which it was part of my dissertation, which I wrote at the LOC, obviously. And in the book, one of the things that I do, if you read in the introduction, you'll see there's a very intricate explanation as to why I talk about why the book covers 62 to 67.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I give a very good, convincing explanation. The real reason, of course, is that I ran out of time, you know. I ran out of time, and so I did not get to write the full book that I wanted. So there's no reason why the book should have started in 62. The reality, I think, is the book should have started in 49. This is the beginning of the Soviet relationship, and then should have continued until at least 69. But I just ran out of time. I wanted to finish my PhD, and that's how it is. So... What should I say about how my views changed? If you read the new book, you'll see there's a lot of new material, in particular about Mao Zedong's psychology. Mao Zedong, it's very strange. It's almost like there are some parallels between Mao Zedong and Putin, because he feels so much resentment for whatever reasons. You know, he kind of constantly feels aggrieved. He feels like he should be owed more. More people should be recognizing him, etc. And he was really unhappy with this role of you know, the Soviets not giving him the proper kind of recognition. So I'll leave it here. You'll see a lot of new materials on the Chinese side in the book, so that should be quite interesting for students studying Sino-Soviet relations. Jeff, to your question, human rights.
Just to interrupt, am I right that the original title for your book was The Second Fiddle?
Yes,
China. Who would be first fiddle and who would be the second?
And that comes. That's exactly right. And of course, this was the.
They shouldn't change the title.
No, it was called the first fiddle, and the Cambridge University Press did not understand the reference. In Russian, it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, it makes total sense. In English, it doesn't make sense, or maybe it doesn't make enough sense, certainly not for Cambridge University Press. And so they're a very good public. But the reason for that was Castro's visit to Moscow at one point and his meeting with Khrushchev, where he asked Khrushchev, what is the problem? What's the reason for your quarrel with China? And Khrushchev said, well, I also don't understand what the problem is. You know, where they accuse us of betraying revolution, but we never betrayed revolution. They're afraid of war, and we're also afraid of nuclear war. So none of this makes any sense. And then he says, here's the real reason. The Chinese want to play the first fiddle. But, he says, in the company of friends, one of them is the leader, and it's not because, you know, he's not even elected, but recognized for some certain qualities. Actually, Khrushchev used the word recognized for some sort of quality. So he basically felt that the Soviet Union was entitled to lead in this context, and China was an upstart. What did the Chinese do? But we did all those things. We sent a person into space, right? So that kind of summarizes it. Yeah. Jeff's question. Human rights obviously becomes a real, real big issue under Carter, and the Soviets feel so upset by this. And I emphasize the word feel, because Soviet leaders, and that was actually broader, it's not just Brezhnev, who's increasingly tuning out of this world by that point, in the late 1970s, mental decline, but also the broader Soviet elites. Indeed, if you even read Chernyayev's diary, you see, you know, Chernyayev fuming there about the case of Bukovsky. He says, this Bukovsky, why are the Americans pressing this case of Bukovsky? It doesn't make any sense. And so the feeling was, and then Brezhnev does actually, at one point, there's an internal discussion about this, and it seems that either Brezhnev or some of his advisors, Alexander Fagentov, but they basically have a discussion. What they have a problem with is this notion that the Americans are teaching the Soviets what they should do or what they should not do. In other words, they're taking a position of moral superiority to the Soviets, and they feel that this is insulting. So it's not that they, and by the way, Brzezinski totally misunderstood that. Brzezinski at that time wrote to Carter saying, they are afraid, when you talk about human rights, they're really, really afraid because they think that, you know, human rights is such a bright idea and everybody, you know, this will, people will abandon communism. That's not the reason. They felt insulted about being taught certain things. They felt that they cannot be taught, that the Americans could not be teachers in this regard, right? And so the situation is exactly parallel with China, where it's like Mao Zedong felt insulted when Khrushchev would tell him certain things. Well, who the hell is Khrushchev? What a clown. How can he teach us? I mean, great civilization, etc. So the Soviets also felt insulted when the Americans brought this issue. So,
okay, more questions on the side? Yeah, please.
Yes, I would like to ask where the Eastern Europe fits in the Soviet search for legitimacy. So this is a region that's conquered by force of arms and Stalinized after the Second World War. So would you say that Soviet leaders were sort of obsessed in finding American legitimacy for this conquest, influence?
Mm-hmm.
And did they seek legitimacy from the leaders of the independent Eastern European states?
Mm-hmm.
And the second
good question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we get a PhD in history here. And my question is on domestic public opinion as a factor in Soviet foreign policy, because
mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert, but like from my understanding of the literature, basically it's considered as a sort of relatively negligible factor, with the exception maybe of the war in Afghanistan. And did you find new evidence on that? Maybe you have new arguments, or did you touch upon it?
Mm-hmm. Right. So very good questions. Very quickly on the question of Eastern Europe, this is a little bit more complicated. So on the question of Eastern Europe, there's this big debate going back to the 1990s about whether Stalin had blueprints for communization of Europe, etc. And of course, Norman Lamarck had a particular view on this that he didn't, and that it just kind of happened. And I tackle this. I have a very detailed discussion of how Stalin was approaching Eastern Europe. Now, the argument that I make there is that Stalin really put a lot of faith in elections, oddly enough. Early on, he thought that
shocking,
you know, a lot of, so he thought that the communists would win in elections in Eastern Europe, and this would all turn out
fine.
You mean
properly managed elections or just elections?
Oh, well, okay, so obviously later it became apparent that properly managed elections meant that, you know, they would be completely fraudulent, and that's the only way that they could be won. But this was not the original idea. He thought, in fact, that perhaps Europe could turn to communism. Remember, in 46, 47, it seemed possible, certainly in the French context, in the Italian context, never mind Eastern European context, Czechoslovak context, the same thing. But then he realized that communism was certainly not popular, not where it was being imposed by force of arms in Eastern Europe. And so that actually brings me to this very interesting question that was tackled by the revisionist historians and also was a subject of debate among, you know, so-called revisionists and traditionalists about who was responsible, when did the Cold War actually happen, who was responsible for the slide towards the Cold War. And this argument that the revisionists used to make, that the Marshall Plan was something that kind of drove Stalin towards greater assertiveness vis-a-vis the West, that common form was formed as a result, as a consequence of that. And I looked at it very closely, and I realized that already by the spring of 1947, Stalin basically decided that's before Marshall Plan. Stalin decided that he needed to consolidate Soviet control in Eastern Europe, that the local population was not going to vote communist unless forced to do so, and you see this in different manifestations, that he was already basically going, by the way, he was already abandoning the so-called percentages agreement with Churchill, which had been agreed to in October 1944. You can see in the spring of 1947, his increasing support for the Greek communist insurgency, which is something he was not supposed to be doing by the terms of this agreement. So Stalin effectively changed his mind. Why did he change his mind? He realized that communism was not a road that you could peacefully travel, or is not a goal that could be reached by a peaceful road. Now, this other question on public opinion in the USSR. And this is interesting, this is a very interesting question. That's, by the way, one of the points of discontinuity with the present day, because today I would argue that public opinion matters a huge deal to people like Putin. And there's a really extensive effort to try to influence and shape public opinion in a particular kind of way. The Soviets didn't care about the public opinion all that much, although they monitored it constantly. They monitored it through KGB surveys, so the KGB would reach out to various people, open correspondence, try to figure out what people were actually thinking. You have those KGB reports in the Central Committee archives, what people thought, what a particular teacher. There was one interesting case of, they were really worried about Maoist ideas taking hold. And so they really were in the 60s. So there would be these reports by the KGB saying, well, teacher so-and-so said that, that Stalin was a great guy, Mao Zedong was also a great guy, etc., this kind of stuff. But in the end, it did not really matter. But what did matter, and this is where the elite consensus really matters. I mean, Brezhnev wanted to have an elite consensus, by which I mean the Central Committee, kind of broader party elites, and that's why he distributed those documents that I'm talking about, right? Or made party speeches in which he said how well he defended the interests of the Soviet Union, the interests of the revolution. It was important to win elite consensus, not so much the public, I think.
Well, we have time for more than two questions, and I see that my students didn't ask a single question. It's completely inadmissible, right? Yeah. Okay, Rob, please.
Sergey, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Great to see you.
Good to see you, too. So my question is about détente. Like, what is your sense of, did this sort of desperate desire on the part of the Soviet leaderships for this recognition and then the American normalization of relations with China, I mean, all of that was really intended at the end of the day to put pressure on the Soviet Union and China to get some kind of outcome on Vietnam, to extricate the Americans from Vietnam. Did you see any evidence that worked? It seems from the anecdote that you told that it didn't work at all.
Yeah, Rohan, I think I would say that it didn't really work because they felt, and this is where it becomes kind of complicated because we have the spirit of détente. Obviously, Brezhnev was quite interested in détente, but it's also important to stress that given the opportunity, I was recently asked to write a review about of a book about the Middle East, of all things. And there was this, the argument of the guy who was writing this book was, well, the Americans were trying to stab the Soviets in the back, but the Soviets had these great intentions and they really wanted to have peace in the Middle East. And I said, what can you argue? That's ridiculous. That is ridiculous. Brezhnev would stab the United States in the back just with as much eagerness as the Americans would stab him in the back. And that is the fundamental truth of détente. Okay, that's why we had a problem. It was so unstable.
But he loved Nixon.
He loved Nixon, and maybe you could, and this is where it becomes complicated, right? Because you wonder whether Brezhnev, and this is where personalities actually matter, because you wonder whether if Nixon stayed in office, Brezhnev was really heartbroken by Watergate. And, he would raise this issue, there's one particularly entertaining discussion in the Soviet Politburo where, I want to say, it was Alexander Fragentov, who writes to Yuri Andropov, the KGB head, says, can we help Nixon with Watergate? Do we have some compromise on those people who were against Nixon? And Andropov responds saying, yeah, well, maybe we'll try to do something. Obviously, they did not succeed. So this is important. This relationship with Nixon is very important. Of course, he himself also kind of drops out of the picture because he had a mental deterioration. And you can see that very well in the document. So up until 74, Brezhnev is very vigorous. He's engaging. After 74, he just goes like this, right? And it just, no questions can be resolved as a result. And then we end up in situations like in Africa or in Afghanistan, where Brezhnev was not even involved in the decision making at all, right? So a personal factor matters, but I think still the systemic factor also matters quite a great deal. I mean, the Soviets were chased out of the Middle East, in particular with the betrayal as the sort of Sadat. The United States won a victory there, and they were quite unhappy. But when an opportunity came about to screw the United States, they would take this opportunity. One good example, Roham, you'll find interesting, is Iran. During the hostage crisis, there was a discussion at the Politburo, and there were some of the members of the Politburo were saying, wait a second, American diplomats were taken hostage by this crazy people. We should help them. The Americans, because this is diplomatic protocol, we should help them, right? And then there was another discussion that said, well, why should we help them? What if we try instead to try to use this opportunity to improve our relationship with Khomeini? And of course, in the end, what they did was they tried to improve their basically mm-hmm. were double dealing, and they wrote letters, Brezhnev wrote letters to Khomeini, and they decided to kind of screw the United States in the case of Iran. So again, you know, friendship or no friendship, you basically, this is the Cold War, it has its own logic, and you just have to do what you have to do.
And again, any neo-realist would just agree with this logic and the behavior of great power. Now, two more questions, Svetozar and then Albert.
Well, thank you very much, Sergei, for this wonderful talk, and welcome back as well. I'm sure you feel nostalgic about the East Building. We were chased by our then departmental manager through the offices of the corridors. Just one short question to give room for our students. You started your talk the issue of legitimacy, saying that you can't quite grasp why was this so important. My question is, isn't this common among all politicians, all sides of the borders, except that somewhere it is called legacy, but all politicians are worried about this. And the two, in my opinion, are the two coins of the same, two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm.
Thank
you.
Maybe we'll pick another question. Okay. Albert.
You mentioned how important China was and all these considerations. To what extent did the Soviet leadership understand the power struggle that was going on within the CCP, particularly during the Cultural Revolution? Because you mentioned how baffled Khrushchev was by what the Chinese were saying, that he didn't understand it.
Great questions. So to tackle Svetozar's question first, Svetozar, I think you're completely right, and that is what I think made this book so interesting to write, because in the end you understand that these people are just people, you know, these politicians, they're just politicians, and maybe if put in those shoes, you would do basically the same thing. So in other words, this book that was supposed to be about the Soviet leadership could be applied to anybody. And in fact, those arguments I make about the Soviet leaders, I also make about the Chinese leaders in the same sort of way, about legitimacy, their concern for legitimacy, their desire to be recognized, and so on. So I think that is something that really to go back to Vlad's point that he raised about psychology. I think that's something that is basic to human psychology that I tried to tackle in the book. I don't know how successful that was, and readers will have to judge for themselves. But I see not just continuity in the Soviet-Russian context. I see applicability around the world, in other words, a broader issue than just the Soviet Union alone or China alone. On Albert's question about Chinese Cultural Revolution or even before that, how much the Soviets understood or not, I think they were baffled a lot of the times. They also made some bad moves, like for example, Khrushchev supported Pan Dahuai, who was obviously, Pan Dahuai during the Great Leap Forward in 1959, wrote a letter to Chairman Mao saying this was a bad idea, basically, and Mao accused him of effectively betrayal, and Khrushchev tried to defend Pan Dahuai, and then what Mao saw in this was a collusion between internal enemies and external enemies. So he thought that the Soviets were definitely trying to, you know, basically find some other basis of support inside China. Later during the Cultural Revolution, the Soviets really lost the plot there. They did not understand what was going on. They struggled to figure out why, you know, people like Lin Biao, for example, who was the obviously Mao's heir apparent, suddenly would flee.
Did you find anything?
Oh, I found. Did it? Well, did I tell you the story about Lin Biao? Okay, this is a great story about Lin Biao.
One minute
on Lin Biao. So I used to live in Mongolia, which was connected to my great years at the LSC here, because the LSC was so damn expensive that I had to go to Mongolia to live there while I was doing my PhD here.
And pick Mongolia in the process.
Well, Mongolia, well, it's thanks to Uncle George Soros, you know, he was the one who gave me the fellowship. So anyway, I was in Mongolia and I was able to get the crash report from Lin Biao's plane. Yeah, the crash report which explained like what happened, etc., which obviously does not actually tell with the Chinese version of events that the plane ran out of fuel. But the funny thing about the crash report was that it had GPS coordinates. And of where the plane crashed. And so then I was visited with a friend of mine, Chinese historian Shen Zhihua visited. And I told Welshan, I said, how about we go, we drive a car out there and we'll see where Indiel's plane crashed. So we got into this car and there are no roads, right? They're just directions. So we drove for like 10 hours in the middle of nowhere.
Is it Gobi Desert or something?
Yeah, it was in Hinti. Hinti, so it's not quite, it's like the steppe, it's not quite the desert. There's no sand per se. But yeah, we found.